And we're back. In part one of this episode, Terrifier snuffed out Malignant. Two more matchups await you, March Mad Men listeners. But first, Mike, Vic, my esteemed co-hosts tonight, I assume you've gotten a fresh infusion of liquid courage before we face off with four more slashers. Mike, I see you're smoking a stogie there. Tell us about that and anything else you're drinking. Are you still on that same can or have you moved on?
Part one of your question says this is a backwoods honey dipped. These are the things that I smoke while I'm riding. And in a sense, this is a creative endeavor. So, you know, it's nice to have a little stoked kind of puff on while you're chit-chatting about horror movies. I am still drinking Smirnoff Ice Smash, peach and mango flavored, 8% alcohol by volume malt liquor. And I'm drinking this because when I was at the store, I saw, you know, what they do is, here I'm going to hold up the can so I can see, they change up the direction of the thing. Oh. I thought I was buying two different flavors, but it's actually the same flavor, they just alternate the pattern of the colors. So I bought the same thing with an alternate color. And I fully understand that, you know, I mean, when it comes to the world of alcohol consumption, I'm basically drinking like Mountain Dew. I don't exactly have a snifter of $300 a bottle of whiskey in front of me. This is like trash to get you smashed at the tailgate.
That's perfect for our movies.
Yeah, because I mean, that's kind of the thing. Is like, ultimately, it fits. Slasher movies are lowbrow films as a genre, as a core. And I think that, you know, we can strive for excellence, but ultimately, on some level, we should embrace the trash in us.
And Vic, how are you embracing the trash tonight?
Let's see, John. Hang on. There we go. That is the I've just taken a cap off of a North Coast Brewing Brother Thelonious, which is not terribly trashy. Mike, I was going to recommend, for much of this podcast, I've been drinking a beer called Backwoods Bastard.
Hey, there you go.
To embrace the backwoodsiness of many of our slashers. This is the opposite of that. This is named for Thelonious Monk, the great jazz musician.
Yeah, dude, with that beer in hand, you should be watching a movie that you snap your fingers in appreciation at the end for.
The sensation of the Cannes Film Festival, yes.
Yeah.
Well, I am kind of more on the Mike side of the spectrum here. I do have my classic skull mug, which makes its appearances on the show. But
it looks like you urinated in that skull mug.
Well, that's because I'm drinking Miller Lite, which bears some resemblance to urine, but it's good cheap beer. It's my cheap beer of choice, so I got to pace myself. I have a call with a boss tomorrow, and I hate to be hungover for those kinds of things. So, yeah,
John, I look forward to playing beer pong with you sometime soon with all that Miller Lite you have in your house.
Anytime, buddy.
No, seriously, I love beer pong. Let's do it.
Oh, me too. Me too. But first, the business at hand is in our old school regional, where the first generation of slasher films reside. These movies were using the original blueprint, if they didn't draw it up themselves. But of course, each makes the formula their own in some way. That's definitely true of one of the movies that we're about to discuss. And the matchup is Sleepaway Camp, number 3 seed. It's got some esteem for it. It's got some love. It's got some momentum. And the underdog tonight is Hell Night, a number 14 seed. And Vic is going to do the honors, tell us about both of these films, and I look forward to hearing all about it. So, Vic, take it away.
You are goddamn right, John. All right, here we go. You guys ready? Sleepaway Camp, 1983, directed by Robert Hiltzik. Budgeted at $350,000, it grossed $11 million. The log line on this one, I just flagrantly copied. I usually try to do a little spin on it, but this is one of those movies that you need to tread lightly around when you're describing the plot. So I will say that Angela Baker, a shy, traumatized young girl, is sent to summer camp with her cousin. Shortly after her arrival, anyone with sinister or less than honorable intentions toward her gets their comeuppance. I mean, come on, that's a as classic a slasher logline as you could come up with. So,
yeah,
I just want to note before we get too far into this, director Robert Hiltzik is now a lawyer. He's a partner in a law firm. He had no idea how popular this movie had become until someone reached out to him in the early 2000s from like sleepawaycampfans.com. And he was like, what? So he eventually returned and directed a direct-to-video sequel called Return to Sleepaway Camp. But those are the only two movies he's ever directed. That feels like a very unique journey in here. And I think you'll find with our next film, there's going to be a lot of unique journeys as we talk about these two films. But that one I wanted to point out. This is another movie that's really hard to talk about without addressing the ending. Maybe more so than any other movie in the competition. But suffice to say that much of what leads up to the climactic scene, which is arguably one of the most famous in horror films in general, feels a little bit perfunctory and not at all deserving of the film's ranking in the old school category. Again, as John mentioned, it's a number three seed. So you just have to trust me that it deserves that ranking. So I'll call out the positive elements that I can. I think Felicia Rose gives a strong central performance. She has to sell a third act reveal, and she does a good enough job that repeated viewings really reveal the nuances in her choices. I also really love Desiree Gold's performance as Aunt Martha. It's a bit of over-the-top camp that really rivals sort of Faye Dunaway and really perks up the opening scenes. And I think Mike Kellen brings a similar energy to the camp owner, Mel, who really serves the same function in the story as the mayor in Jaws. I think the deaths are visceral, and they have a giallo feel. We mentioned this in our last episode. They really have a giallo feel to them, especially the pedophile head chef getting scalded by a pot of boiling water. I mean, it's a really brutal death scene. I remember that from my first viewing of this as a preteen. But I actually made a note on an early scene. Everyone, the bunch of people are standing around as the campers are coming out, and the pedophile is making a bunch of disgusting comments about the young girls coming in. And what I wrote down was, see, it's funny because the cook is a pedophile. Which really seems to be the joke in it, which is just troubling. But there's an unusual amount of male nudity here, especially relative to the female nudity, including a skinny dipping scene that seems to feature all boys, which I'm really just calling out for a genre that tends to objectify women. Just really unusual to see this much naked boy ass, but, you know, okay. But it really does all come down to the ending. This is one of the most iconic endings in horror films, and it not only prompts discussion today, but it's a discussion that seems to be constantly changing. I've really done a lot of research into this for reasons that I can't get into, but suffice it to say that I believe this is, in the pantheon of horror films, a really important film. I just can't tell you why. Incidentally, I think we should create an awards category now. This film really inspired this, although it's come up before. We need an award category for our end of the season for the most unrealistic sports scenes. I think the softball scene in this movie isn't bad, but the volleyball scene is right up there with the basketball and Slumber Party Massacre for the worst ever put on film.
Well, thank you, Vic. That was a great lead off. Why don't you go ahead and tell us about Hell Night, as is customary.
Fucking A. Let's talk about Hell Night, the 14 seed. From 1981, directed by Tom DeSimone. This one, the box office is $2.3 million. I don't know what the budget was. The log line, again, just pilfered from IMDb, is that four college pledges are forced to spend the night in a deserted old mansion where they are stalked by the monstrous survivor of a family massacre years earlier. There's lots of things I want to talk about with this, but I just want to point out that I feel like the most interesting thing about this movie is really the people involved. All right? So director Tom DeSimone cut his teeth directing porn films, particularly gay porn, but he broke through into the mainstream really with this. He did another film called Chatterbox that I haven't seen, but then this, which was profitable. He eventually wound up being a pretty prolific TV director. Remember, I talked about how there's some unusual paths being represented by these two films. That's not a path you see to directing episodic TV very often. But even more fascinating to me is Vincent Van Patten, who plays Seth in this. I think he gives one of the best performances in the film. He is the son of Dick Van Patten. If you don't know who that is, look him up. Vincent Van Patten was a professional tennis player who once was ranked 26th in the world and beat John McEnroe in a tennis tournament in Tokyo. When his acting career fizzled, he became a notable poker player, hosted a famous Hollywood poker game in his house that was regularly attended by Ben Affleck and Tobey Maguire, and then spent 17 years as a commentator for the World Poker Tour. And he was married to Betsy Russell, who was a regular in the latter Saw sequels.
Huh.
Right? I'm telling you, it's fascinating, right? And I'm just getting started, John. So sit back, all right? Chuck Russell, who will be making an appearance later in this season, was an executive producer on this. Frank Darabont was a PA. The cinematographer was Mac Allberg. Mm-hmm. He was Stuart Gordon's DP on Reanimator, From Beyond, and Dolls. The composer, Dan Wyman, worked as an orchestrator for John Carpenter on Halloween, Assault on Precinct 13, and The Fog. It goes on and on and on. I would have given anything to be at the rap party for Hell Night. The movie itself is pretty good if you're grading on an early 80s slasher curve. There's not much that's terribly original, but what's there is generally well executed. I think the characters are distinct. I think the setting is great. But seriously, who lit all those fucking candles? This drives me crazy in movies. Some scenes are lit with like 7,000 candles. The facilities manager in me just screams fire hazard. Anyways, Linda Blair unfortunately got a Razzie nomination for this. I don't think she deserved that. She's not brilliant, but she's fine. She offers a bit of a departure from the typical virginal final girl. I think Vincent Van Patten gives a strong performance. He has a great monologue about surfing and why he loves it that I think really fits his character. It's well delivered. There's some really, really impressive tracking shots. Maybe a few too many. I think some of them go on too long. There's a scene of Seth climbing over the gate to get out that has these spikes at the top. It's just brutal. It's really well done. And there's a great shot of someone coming up from the floor under a carpet behind them that's really chilling. One of the things I've really seized on, this especially applies to Seth getting over the gate, the most suspenseful scenes, I think, in a lot of these slasher films are really just the simplest. Like, I really come to appreciate setting up, okay, here's an obstacle, here's the thing, how are you going to get over it, and just making it sort of as simple as possible, but it's just really well executed. Now, there's plenty to complain about, too. I wrote over and over again in my notes that the character of Jeff is dumb because Jeff is dumb. He's a poorly written character. I actually kind of understood when there's another scene of a boyfriend, in this case Jeff, getting his ass kicked while the girlfriend watches. Remember, I brought that up as a trope. I was just kind of happy that Linda Blair stood there and watched Jeff get his ass kicked. The makeup on the antagonist is really unimpressive. I really think that if it had been closer to the work on the Funhouse, it really would have kicked the movie up a notch. But overall, this is solid slashing. It doesn't play as well the second time, but I think it has a few elements to recommend it.
All right. Well, that was a very kind and charitable review. And I think you definitely hit on a lot of things. You certainly found its strengths. Mike, when did you see this? Did you have a relationship with it before or now?
Let me tell you this. I had seen Hell Night a million years ago when I was still just hoovering up all the horror movies that I could get my hands on. I was just running to any video store, just grabbing anything, dot, dot, dot. So I've seen Hell Night a long, long, long time ago, probably while I was still in high school and or even perhaps junior high. And the only shot, image thing, anything that hung out in my mind was the shot of when Seth gets grabbed from behind the pillar and the shotgun clatters into this, you know, there's a stretch of moonlight that's coming in through the doorway and the shotgun is kind of spotlit by that stretch of moonlight, and Linda Blair running down to get it, and, you know, a galoot coming out to give her a hard time. And for whatever reason, that was the thing that stuck out in my mind. As, you know, if you were to go into my hard drive and open the file labeled Hell Knight, that is all you would find, right? So, on the one hand, I'm like, yeah, I've seen this movie, la, 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 la. But it's been literally decades. So, when I watch it a couple of days ago, I was watching it pretty much with fresh eyes. And at the top of the viewing, I was like, oh boy, here we go. Because, like, our opening scenes are drunk party kids in a key that we've seen 100 million times before. And it really felt like the movie's going to be settling for, like, some very broad and obvious choices, right? Especially when, like, the party kind of drags everyone out to the evil house where they're going to have to stay for the night. And this is a small thing that gets me a lot, but when people in movies randomly go, woo, 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 to show that they're having a fun and wild time, that makes me roll my eyes and laugh at the same time. And for another example, let's take the opening scenes of Friday the 13th Part 5. Where we have the two guys like digging up Jason's grave, and they're just like, woohoo, 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 woohoo.
Wasn't that 6?
No.
They're digging up 5. His actual grave in the one that he's not in?
It's the one where Corey Feldman is having the flashback, so it might be 4.
Oh, yeah, wait.
Is it 4? Yeah, it's 4. Anyway, it's one that's shot in someone's backyard. It's where it's just two guys digging up Jason, and it turns out to be like a dream sequence.
Oh, no, that is 5. That is 5.
Yeah, that is 5. Yeah.
Okay. So, mm-hmm.
Anyway, so.
Also directed by a porn director.
Yeah. So characters yelling, woo, I was like, oh boy, here we go.
It's a porn right? thing.
Anyway. Here is the thing, though, is this movie, by degrees, started to really win me over as it went on, to the extent that, like, about halfway through, I started thinking, oh, shit, this might be a little bit of an upset vote for yours truly between these two movies, because I am as deeply, you know, as very much high regard I hold Sleepaway Camp as any right-thinking person should. I was watching Hell Knight. I'm like, man, I'm really enjoying this movie. This is really fucking good. And it starts with when they get up to the gate, and the gate is locked up with chains, and they have the big lock. And there's like, okay, now you have to go into this place, and this is something that happens every year. You have the pledges have to go in, and it's funny because it's not even specific to like a particular fraternity. It's two guys and two girls, so apparently it's like a joint hazing thing.
Well, they have relationships between certain sororities and certain fraternities. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, that early party scene where it's just like, you know, our two main lead girls walk in and we cut over to the guys in the corner and they're slavering over there. And it's like, oh, yeah, look at her. I'm just like, come on, man. It's 1981 slasher movie shit. Oh, dude, this is going to be a fucking wait, man. But then what happens is they get up to the front gate and he pulls out a pistol and shoots the lock off. I'm like, okay. That's interesting. And then gives the gun to the guy. Anytime you want, you leave. You know, not a key, because what they're doing is, spoiler alert, they're loading in the twist that the gun has blanks in it. But if you're gonna have gun with, it's like they're not like, if you ever want to leave through this locked gated, you know, this locked gate, here is a key to undo the lock. Instead, they say, here is a pistol to shoot off the lock.
Right. Like,
okay. Okay. And so in they go. And again, I was going into this movie with low expectations because I didn't remember anything about it. The initial party scene, it was like, boy. And then we get this giant exposition dump about the family that used to live here.
It's like pages of the Bible, like, and then there was this child, and then there was that child.
Yeah, and it's just like, dude, no one gives one. It, you know, this isn't the fucking Terminator. No one gives a shit about any of this stuff. And I understand that you always need to establish the backstory of the Galoot, so you understand where the killer is coming from, but it's just like, I mean, this thing is fucking overboard. There's like a page-long monologue about the family history of this crazy... And in a Lovecraft short story, yes, absolutely, 100%. In 1901 slasher film, no, motherfucker, no. Stop it. But here is the thing. They get into this big spooky mansion where some murders should have taken place, and it's a fraternity hazing thing. And in a weird kind of way, this is where we come back to where I feel about Terrifier, because this is a setup that feels so basic that you would think that there are a million movies out there that are playing the same hand of cards, right? But really, when you actually think about how many movies are there where it's like a fraternity prank, you have to go to the haunted place and there's a galoot that chases you around. I mean, there are certainly more than one, but if you're gonna watch the one that like perfectly encapsulates this very basic slasher setup, it would be Hell Night, right?
Mm-hmm.
What better movie exemplifies this logline? So they're in this, and two interesting things. As much as I had a low opinion of the initial party scene, the good thing about that setup is once the four main characters are in the setting, because we don't know anything about them as characters, they don't know anything about each other. You know, the two guys and the two girls have been kind of thrown into the situation willy-nilly, happenstance. And so they have to talk to each other and be like, so who are you? And so in a weird kind of a way, it's very organic that we get their backstory and their characters. And thus we get like these, you know, the fun monologue from Seth about how much he loves surfing. But also, here's the thing. We established that Jeff, the dumb guy, is like kind of a rich kid, and he's just kind of like doing this because it's expected of him. But here's the thing. We use this to set up the fact that Linda Blair's character grew up in her father's mechanic shop. And it gives us one of the more wonderful scenes in Act 3. It's a purely classic setup and payoff. It's beautifully done.
Yeah.
And so, and I will say that if Linda Blair got a Razzie for this movie, I have a very dim view of the Razzies as like even a concept, because they're almost always wrong on top of anything else.
Wasn't The Shining nominated for Razzies?
Yeah. Exactly.
Say no more.
For one thing, it's a shitty thing to do. For another thing, they're frequently wrong, because you know, Linda Blair is, I found while I was watching her performance, she was finding interesting little things to do that I mean, she was completely organic. And here is the thing, is she is at this stage in her career, she's coming off of The Exorcist, where she's playing a child, right? So she's looking for roles that transitions her to adult roles. So on the one hand, she is this very like cherubic girlish face, so she does easily plug into the idea of the classic bookish girl with no boyfriend slasher movie protagonist. But they go, but due to the fact that it's like a not only like a fraternity sorority thing, but it's also Halloween, so we can put these characters into costumes, right? And her costume is, she's like a bodice, you know, 18th century big dress is what she's doing, right? That gives us two things. For one thing, she can organically show her cleavage, which is impressive.
Mm-hmm.
But for another thing, we get something that's very interesting, or at least I found interesting. It's the fact that, do you guys remember Targets?
Yes. The Bogdanovich film?
Yep. Do you remember Targets?
Of course, with
Boris Karloff.
Frankenstein, yeah.
Exactly. The point of that movie was that we have to leave the corny Hammer horror film stuff behind, because real world horrors are far more scary. For instance, crazy dude with a gun, you know, who will just like shoot innocent people. he's making that juxtaposition because he's like, you know, this crowd of characters goes to a drive-in theater. They're going to watch like this corny thing where it's like Boris Karloff. They're in a castle. They're worried about like ghosts or a werewolf or something like that. And the true horror is we have a nut with a rifle like shooting people in their cars. Right.
The true horror is that it's not as easy to get around on the LA freeways as it was in that movie, because it's really painful watching traffic flow in that movie.
But I, weirdly enough, I was thinking about targets while I was watching Hell Knight.
Huh.
Because Hell Knight is obviously aiming for the same target as your Friday the 13th, your Halloween's, and early 80s slasher movie, where we're paying off the idea of a galoot is going to charge around, grab attractive teenagers, and murder them in ridiculous fashion, right? But what is our setting? Our setting is gothic. Our protagonist is dressed in this gothic dress. And in terms of who the galoots are, and I, you know, not to spoil anything, but there's, you know, plural galoots. But the idea being that the setup itself is very Lovecraftian. In terms of our antagonists, I was thinking about Lovecraft's The Lurking Fear. I was thinking about The Outsider. You know, it has a very close resemblance to Castle Freak. You know, the idea that we have these inbred psychos.
House living... of
Usher? Yeah, exactly. It's in a weird kind of a way, it's like Lurking Fear by way of House of Usher, by way of Texas Chainsaw Massacre, in the sense that they have like a dinner party scene with corpses set up in the basements. There's a little bit of psycho with that. You know, and I loved that kind of mashup of very, on the one hand, very gothic style of horror, because we even have a sequence in which Linda Blair in her like 18th century wardrobe is like running along the gables of the the rooftops of this old mansion while a crazy guy is chasing after her, and he's like a monster who lives in a basement. It's a really interesting mashup, and I liked the fact that I looked at the filmmakers who made this movie, and I saw, Vic, as you did, the backstory of the director. And see, here's the thing, man, it's like I very competent shooting. That fence sequence is honestly full of a lot of tension. It's very good. And I also like that they're going out of their way to you know, Linda Blair is like, it's very clear that they brought in a ringer for this production. There's like, we need a name. And they got Linda Blair. And so they're giving her like some star beats, right? So it's like, you know, when Seth is going to try to climb over the thing, she's going to at least try, right? Of course, she's going to be our final girl, but like, she's the one who's like kind of figuring out stuff. She's always like kind of doing things. She's never like a eek, help me kind of a protagonist, right? That sequence where the guy comes up under the carpet, I really liked, because the music doesn't sting that beat until the very end. You're really left to notice it on your own for the majority of that shot, which I loved. Like, I didn't notice it until the music brought my attention to it. And then I looked at him, I'm like, oh shit, there's a dude coming up in the carpet under the rug. And I looked, you know, what I did was I stopped and I went back to the top of the scene.
I did the same thing, Mike. Dude. I had to rewind it and go, oh wait, where the fuck did that guy come from?
And that's the thing, is like, there's one school of thought that says that you should, you know, Hitchcock it, that you should play the fuck out of the dun 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 dun, that you should Jaws it, right, from moment one. I actually really liked that director just kind of let that happen in the background and let you find it, and only points it out at the very end. I dug the aesthetic. I dug the choices. There are some beats at the very end that made me honestly clap and be like, dude, that's fucking great. Our setup is a classic. It's kind of like a really interesting classic mashup of like classic gothic horror and early 80s slashers. I dug the performances a lot. I dug the writing a lot. I dug the directing a lot. You know, the gore was pretty good. I liked the monsters. And like, I was really liking Hell Knight to the extent that like the whole time I was watching, I'm like, oh shit, are we going to upset the sleepaway camp? This might be an upset vote on my part. And then I rewatched Sleepaway Camp, and, you know, that was it.
That was great. That was great. Wow, well, I kind of feel like I might be on a little bit of an island in that I was pretty distinctly underwhelmed with this movie. I have some nice things to say, but I had never seen it before. I watched it in the lead up to this season of the podcast because I knew that, you know, Vic liked it. It didn't make a huge impression on me, but there were elements that I did really like, and, you know, I didn't put up any fuss when it came time to seed the field for the tournament. First and foremost, it was fun to see a young, but not too young, Linda Blair in a conventional slasher movie. She doesn't exactly have a long and multi-tiered career, so for me, there was a real curiosity aspect to watching Regan from The Exorcist in a movie like this down the road a few years. She's certainly more cute than hot, but the character does seem a lot more substantive than the average final girl. And as a, you know, really quick tie-in to our previous episode, I think that if Terrifier had the level of character development and dialogue that this movie has, I think it would have gained points in my view without, yeah, being, you know, genius or anything. So there is kind of a middle ground, and I think this movie represents a more attainable level of characterization and character interaction. I found her more interesting than the average final girl, and thus kind of more attractive in a sort of real person way. The fact that she's trained as an auto mechanic is a nice wrinkle, and of course it pays off down the road, no pun intended. By the time we finally recorded this episode, though, like tonight, a lot of months had gone by since the last time, so I figured I better give it another at least partial watch, and it didn't enthrall me the second watch. I kind of did some fast-forwarding, and I'll explain why, but I do like that this setup has similarities to the haunted house genre. I think Mike alluded to this, the mystique of the place, the murders that had happened there years earlier is the dominant element at first. But in that same, as I put it charitably, rich vein of exposition, we also get who the killer is and why he's still here. So I kind of like that, in a sense, that they bury the lead in, like, they give you a lot of expo, but there's that little nugget of, oh, and this is actually the guy, or I guess it's guys, but that you're dealing with. At the same time, that means there's not a lot of mystery about what happens or why. The real mystery is why now, and this is just classic Hollywood question, but if staying on a night in this house is a prerequisite for membership in the fraternity, surely many a pledge has lived to tell the tale. I don't know why this particular Halloween night everybody gets murdered, but putting that aside, I also like that they keep referring, like we should just know this, that these guys are gorks. I guess that didn't catch on.
I did key off that term. I did key off that term. She refers to him like even directly, like, get away from you, Gork. Yeah. And I didn't know if that was like for that. I'm like, was that their last name or no? It's Marston or something, right? It's just the for one movie in the entire world that is the shorthand for a galoot. Gork is as good of a fucking name for these guys as a galoot, so who the fuck cares?
I could see that catching on. I mean, it does work. It's better than fetch. So the place is very well maintained for an abandoned mansion, I notice. The kids even feel comfortable sleeping or potentially fucking in the beds. Kind of minimal cobwebs and whatnot. But it is a movie where the kids' banter and all that before the villain even shows his hand is more entertaining, at least it was to me, than a lot of the sneak and creep stuff that dominates the second half of the movie. I remember being a little bored with all that the first time, and I don't think it's an accident that we don't even get more than one half-hearted fake scare until 27 minutes into the film, when the first kill abruptly happens, and it's not especially effective. Second kill, 35 minutes in, also pretty routine. Third, I didn't find it any better. By the way, it's just striking me, it's interesting that we're all talking about like very different things, but that's the great thing about three different perspectives on a movie. I didn't love that there wasn't a lot of creep factor to the location beyond what these fraternity goons JC's haunted house is bringing to the table. It's not genuinely all that atmospheric of a place outside of their sort of tricks, except then suddenly there's a Gork jumping on people from time to time. And I didn't
forget the 7,000 candles, John.
Yeah, that the property. I don't have property management or facilities management on my resume.
I will say this: that wonderful beat with the rug, the guy coming up through the rug, it shows that there are secret doors in this location. Mm-hmm. And if there was anything that I found wanting, I want to see more of that. I want to see the idea that these killers have this warren of secret doors throughout the entire place. I was disappointed by the fact that we only really get like one of them. I kind of sort of two, because while they're in the dungeon, they manage to escape through another one.
The girl falls through one near the beginning too, when they're creeping back in to scare them.
Yeah, and that's kind of the thing is I wanted that to, in a weird kind of a way, I wanted that to be the movie, if that makes sense.
A little more people under the stairs.
A little more young Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah.
Wow. Deep cut, Kuchak.
I went to film school, too.
There's also an old movie called The Cat and the Canary that had kind of some of this stuff. And it is a gothic thing, I think, for sure.
Right. John, now you're just showing off, dude. That's fun.
No, but that is the idea. You know, that's what, to my mind, kind of makes this movie kind of interesting. Is we're welding, like, really broad early, you know, late 70s, early 80s slasher movie beats to a very gothic tale. John, I think you're the one who said that it might as well be ghosts, you know, but they're slashers. Mm-hmm. You know, they're galoots. They're gorks, purely because that's just what the flavor of the month is. I appreciate this movie for what it is.
Yeah.
I like the mashup.
Well,
I think it's competent.
Sure. I think it's competent as well. When I said, though, that I was fast-forwarding, I want to tell you what I was fast-forwarding. It's people slowly moving around the space, just kind of burning screen time. It's an hour and 42 minutes, and having seen it 3 months ago and then watching it again now, I was just kind of like, all right, you know, get on with it. I want to watch the high points. But once the characters stopped talking to each other, I was less interested. We're down to three characters at the 54-minute mark. And I do like the climbing the gate sequence. I made a note of that as well. Some really cool cinematic dynamics there. The sharp blades at the top are really striking visually. Great design. I mean, that's why it's on the poster, right? It's on the poster I saw. And
they pay off at the end.
Yeah.
And I should say that I really like the fact that Seth is, at the top of the movie, shown to be like kind of the obnoxious character. He's like the dude who wants to have sex and that. Ordinarily, this is a character that we would dispose of very early. It struck me that rather than dispose of him early, what the movie does is it plays another common trope of this genre, is it introduces the characters who are going to play a prank on the main characters. And that gives us a subset of low-level characters that we can just kind of murder. In a certain way, they earn their murder with the audience.
Sure.
Because they're up to something that's a little bit no good. They're playing a prank. I mean, it's not like a capital crime, but, you know, they're not being good. They're not being supportive, And you know, I like the fact that, like, not only does Seth get over those spikes, spoiler alert, but, like, he has, like, an entire act two arc.
Yeah.
And he manages to get to the police station. He gets a gun. He does the entire thing. I should say there's another trope that this movie plays in the slasher genre, and that is the fact that the killings go on because there is a failure of the local police. Very common trope in the slasher movie genre. And in this case, Seth Runt makes it to the police station. He says, hey, my friends are being murdered. And the police are just like, ah, you're in that fraternity. Get out of here. It's just a prank. And we have two failures of police work in this scene. One, they don't believe him when he runs in and says, hey, my friends are being murdered. They tell him to go fuck himself, right?
Yeah.
The second one is they have an evidence room full of loaded weapons with an unlocked door right next to that. So he's able to just run into the next room, grab a loaded pump action shotgun, and escape through the window.
Yeah. Yeah. Make of that what you will. But I will say I was really worried for his nuts when he was crawling over that fence. So that's a well-staged sequence.
Given the fact that the director had shot a lot of gay porn before this. You might have like a deep bench of how to shoot, worrying about what happens to a dude's nuts.
he knows how to build suspense about nuts.
I want to thank you both. I'm going to have nightmares about Seth's ripped open scrotum now as he gets over the fence. That's horrifying. Well done.
That's a great segue back to Sleepaway Camp.
I was going to say, does anybody have any... Jesus.
Spoiler alert.
Well, I'll lead this one off. My yeah. thoughts. I've seen it like four times in the last 5 years, largely because it was kind of a discovery to me. And then something I wanted to pass along. I had never seen it, guys, like up until recently. And I wanted to share it with other people once I saw it. And then I had to see what Joe Bob Briggs thought of it. So I watched it again for that. And so I actually haven't watched it specifically again for our podcast because it's pretty fresh on my mind. But I will explain why I'd never seen it, because I always thought it would be super cheesy, you know, just from like the, I knew there were sequels and that looking at the box covers in video stores when I was a kid. And I also clearly got the vibe, even without knowing any twist or anything, that it lacked the kind of iconic hulking killer that I prefer in these movies, what Mike likes to call the galoot, which I'm totally on board with. And you know what? It is an ultra low budget indie production that lacks.
It's a gork, John.
Yeah. Gork. I'm on board with gork too. In fact, let's make gork happen. Yeah. But that doesn't.
Staying with galoot.
you're a purist.
No. If I was a purist, I would use the term mongoloid, but about 3 or 4 years ago, I used that term in a podcast, and you informed me that gave your mother a tummy ache to use that word. So please, Mike, be more politically correct. Don't call Jason Voorhees a mongoloid, even though Fangoria has been calling him mongoloid for 20 years. Don't use that word because it's not properly, and my mommy is getting upset, so please don't use that term.
God, why didn't I put that on the episode 100, man? Damn, that sounds like a great excerpt to throw out there. But
no, you took me aside before the episode to let me know that mongoloid was no longer an appropriate term. It was now problematic in your mind. So from that point forward, I switched to galoot. So here we are.
Well, you know what? I think galoot's pretty awesome. So yay, John.
I agree. I actually really enjoy galoot. So please edit out this part of me being slightly politically incorrect. I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings.
No, leave this in because I want to upset John's mother.
If if my mom listened to the podcast, I might have a different opinion, but she does not.
Mike, I'm always trying to upset John in this. It never occurred to me to try to upset his mother in the podcast.
It's a whole new front in the war.
apparently, she throughout the entire course of human history, she listened to the exact 5 minutes during which I used the word mongoloid. In John's mommy's defense, I will say that it is incorrect. It is an incorrect usage of that word, but I was only using that word because when I was growing up, reading Fangoria would refer to Jason Voorhees as a mongoloid. And so I thought that was just like a term for like a giant twisted individual. Thanks to social justice, I've seen the lights, and you know, I'm just a better person for it. I'm no longer problematic, Vic. So,
you know what? Well, Mike, I will tell you this on that note, check out a band called The Who, H-U.
I'm well aware.
Yeah. Okay, good. All right. Never mind.
On the one hand, Vic, yes, I'm glad that you're listening to The Who, and I appreciate the idea that you would be like, yes, Mike, you should listen to this music that I like, and you should listen to it. On the other hand, who the fuck are you talking to, man? Come on. It's like...
Fair enough.
Hey, Mike, have you heard of this writer named Stephen King?
Okay, now that is not an apples-to-apples comparison, you fucking...
All right, I'm just being a dick. I'm just being a dick.
Cocks in hell, John.
What's that one from?
I'm sorry, Mrs. I didn't mean that.
Now that I'm cutting out. How dare you? How dare you? Okay, let's get back on track.
Your mother sucks mongoloid cocks in hell, John.
Okay, now it has to stay in.
Now we have the new title of my autobiography.
Or at least this episode. Okay.
Your mother...
mother sucks mongoloid cocks in hell.
I'm sorry.
I'm the title of something.
So I'm going to need 30 seconds to piss out my Smirnoff Ice Smash Fair enough. Melt liquor.
This is as good a time as any. Oh, gotta love Mike.
Good stuff.
Hey, the trains don't run on time, but we have fun.
Anyway, so we're doing a podcast, right?
Yep. I was really into sleepaway camps, well, campy vibe, but it somehow for me reads more bold and individualistic than kind of wink, wink, nudge, nudge jokiness, which you often get with quote-unquote campy movies, which I'm generally not into. Without being deadly serious, this movie has the kind of personal dramatic stakes, quirky authenticity, and cruel edge that a slasher needs to be taken seriously on the levels on which it actually needs to be taken seriously. We can believe these are real people in life and death situations, and some very nasty things happen in this movie, both verbally and physically, because the characters are colorful to the point of being over the top, but it doesn't mean the movie is messing around. When it needs to be hardcore, it does so in pretty convincing fashion, culminating in a final shot, as Vic alluded to, that surely belongs in a discussion, along with Child Jason lunging out of the lake in Friday the 13th Part 1, or any other ultimate or penultimate moment that we'll never forget in one of these movies. I can tell you that Sleepaway Camp is goofy, funny, bizarre, disturbing, and haunting. Tough for one little movie made by nobodies to be all of those things, in a good way. But this one manages it. It's a gem.
Yeah, it's okay.
It's all right.
Yeah. All right. Yeah.
It's a good little movie. It's a good little movie, you know? It doesn't suck.
John's generic stereotype.
That was really
any subgroup.
That was my sleepaway camp counselor voice, which...
Oh, man. Hey, come on, guys. Short shorts? Like, I looked at the outfits in this, and I was like, holy shit. Like, I didn't realize people actually ran around like that.
Yeah, you mentioned that earlier. Campy is often associated with the gay community. I don't know what specifics with the filmmakers, but, like, this movie has a lot of elements that they come from that perspective, and great, but yeah, like if anything, we're looking at the male body in a more appreciative way in this film than you often see, I think is fair.
I like one of the more protagonistic supporting characters is the one camp counselor who's basically like a really built dude. Mm-hmm. And a lesser movie, we would make him like the mean evil jock guy. And in this movie, he is consistently like he's protecting kids from being bullied. He's on the side of our protagonists. He's generally on the side of good. You know, the fact that he is actually shown with like a bodybuilder magazine does not instantly make him a villain, as we very often see in very, you know, specifically slasher movies, but also like late 70s, early 80s movies where it's like, you know, the big dumb jock guy. He's either dumb or he's mean or a combination of both. Like, the fact that he likes to work out is not held against him. I like that.
Yeah. Like, and if we're just grading on a curve between last episode, the Terrifier characters, the Hell Knight characters, and the Sleepaway Camp characters, I like the Sleepaway Camp characters the best.
Yeah. All right. Let me talk about Sleepaway Camp for a second.
Oh, shit. Oh, there it is.
It's a Corona Refresca Mas. Citrus, mango citrus, mango e-citrusco, flavorful tropical cocktail, 8% by volume. It's a malt beverage.
Corona does one of those? Nice.
I just went down the row at the store, man. I just bought all these things.
You're in a very tropical mode.
I'm going to run out and grab something, but Mike, go ahead and talk, because this is going to take me a couple seconds. So, John, just don't kick it over to me for a second.
Well, I guess Vic has nothing to say.
I've done that on you guys a couple of times. I don't give a shit. But, long story short, here are my condensed thoughts on Sleepaway Camp. Sleepaway Camp, like Hell Night, is one of the movies that when I was, you know, in junior high, high school, I was, horror movies. I was running to the store. I was watching everything I could get my hands on, and Sleepaway Camp was one of them. And for whatever reason, like, I remember liking it, but it never stood out in my mind until I circled back around to it, like, you know, maybe a decade later. And especially the ending scene, I was like, what the fuck? And by degrees, I've grown to, go from like, to like straight up just love this movie. And my 6 degrees of separation is the management production company that I used to work at as the senior vice president of development. One of our clients was a guy named Michael A. Simpson, who directed Sleepaway Camp 2 and 3. And during the glut of remakes in the aughts, we were with Michael leaning hard into trying to get a Sleepaway Camp remake made. And Richard Bilzik was adamant about holding on to those rights, perhaps because he was a lawyer. He knew exactly what he had in hand. He couldn't be tricked out of them. He couldn't be talked out of them.
Right.
And so as we were trying to work with this guy, we could never pry the rights out of his hands. We never got that movie made, which at the time seemed like a massive failure on our part, because it's like, it's such a fastball down the middle. How do we not remake Sleepaway Camp? Obviously he did, because he had the rights eventually, but XYZ. On rewatching Sleepaway Camp again, after several years, because, I watched it like, the first, those three movies like a million times when we're trying to get this fucking remake made in the early to mid aughts. But it's been since then. The last time that I've watched Sleepaway Camp was probably like 05, 06, right? So
oh, yeah.
15 some odd years. And I was able to watch it with a degree of fresh eyes. Oh boy, did I love it. I love the fact that, for one thing, 1981 money?
Yeah.
And $350,000 goes a long way, man. I mean, we have a boat accident. Little minor stuff that I, due to the fact that I've done budgets on horror feature films, I'm watching like scenes where I'm just like, oh fuck, they have an entire room full of underage extras. God damn. Like 100 kids in this room, man. What the fuck?
Yeah.
I like the fact that they have, like, honestly, young kids, because this is, and for this reason, because ultimately a lot of these conversations about horror movies and slasher movies in particular become about, what are these movies like really about? And we find that slasher movies specifically often involve an added danger to a rite of passage in some way. That's why very often our protagonists are teenagers, and that rite of passage might be a birthday or sex or holiday.
To the point that, Mike, if you actually made a slasher movie set at a retirement home, that would be just blow the whole paradigm apart, right?
Dude, I'm telling you this. It's like it's almost weirdly prescient that you brought that up, because I was thinking about that while I was watching Sleepaway Camp. Because when I watched my own parents retire, I noticed that in older years, people, they live their lives in reverse. There actually is a period of time where it's almost like a second puberty.
Adolescence?
Yeah, adolescence, where like in their like late 50s, early 60s, they're just doing nothing but getting drunk and fucking.
in the 70s.
So the parallels are there.
Yeah.
You should write that. That's a great idea.
Dude, I'm telling you, man. I was thinking about hardcore while I was watching Sleepaway Camp, because I'm just like, the same experiences that you have when you're, you know, especially the fact that our lead character actually is 13. You automatically feel a deep level of sympathy for this character, A, because she's a kid. She's just a little girl, right? And also, B, she's not doing anything to anybody. If everyone just left this kid alone, everything would be fine.
When I alluded to the cruelty, verbal and physical, 80% of that has nothing to do with the kills.
that's the thing, is you touch on the child molester, Cook, and I suspect that on some level the film is leaning into that in like kind of a dark humorish kind of way, like a trauma film, but it is so fucking gross and disgusting and evil, and especially when like he backs her into the fucking the pantry and like starts unzipping his pants, and I'm just like, what the fuck, this movie is going there, man. What the fuck
again? So, like, no punches pulled, this movie passes that test.
This movie is going there.
Yeah, and so this character instantly earns his fate, and so when he gets that pot of boiling water dumped on his head, spoiler alert, I noticed that two things from that sequence. A, I noticed that some POV killer shots, but they're far more furtive than we ordinarily see in slasher movie POV killer shots. Ordinarily, POV killer shots in slasher movies are very methodical or heavy breathing or something like this, but it's almost like a monkey is watching him. It's scurrying around, right? And then when we actually dump the thing on him, we hang on him suffering from that burn for a really long time.
Yeah.
And I think that happens for two reasons. One, we want to make the most of the really good effect shots. Mm-hmm. You know, if we're going to spend the money on the effects, let's look at them. And also, two, we want to watch that character suffer. And that is where we kind of circle around to, what do we actually get out of slasher movies? When I was watching that child molester Cook suffer from third degree burns on his face, and I was enjoying it. I was really enjoying the character suffering for a long, long time. I could have watched that all fucking day. Slasher movies are basically forgivable sadism.
Well, without getting into spoilers, I do think this is one of the more sympathetic slashers that you're ever going to run across.
The movie finds like ironic or interesting things to do with its kills, like the guy who is like, he thinks he's playing a trick on a girl, and he's teasing her, he's scaring her with the idea of like, watch out for the water snakes, watch out for the water snakes, and then when his corpse is found, a water snake slithers out of his corpse's mouth.
Right.
I love that. I was clapping at it. That the character work and the writing is cranked up to 11 in the best possible way. It's like everyone is like playing for the cheap seats. They're slugging it out of the park. It's like, especially like the girl Julie, like every line reading, it's like, why did she get to not play volleyball and instead she gets to talk to boys? It's like, dude, I was dying laughing at all of the line reads. Like, I loved the camp guy with the cigar. I was like, and especially when he decides out of nowhere that our protagonist's brother is somehow the killer. He just kind of lands on that. But we have this really wonderful sequence where, on the one hand, makes zero fucking sense. He just decides that this kid is like a mass murderer, this 13-year-old kid. And he's got the cigar in his mouth. He's shaking the kid. He's like, confess, confess. And in the background, what's happening is a bully camp counselor is throwing his sister into the water, and she's deeply hydrophobic, and it's like this horrible thing to happen to this character, and that's happening way off in the background, while in the foreground a really awful thing is happening to this other character that we're sympathetic with.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's really well constructed. That I mean, as over the top and cranked up to 11 and campy, literally it's campy happening on the camp.
Yeah.
But in terms of the filmmaking, it's fucking great. I love their weird aunt. Like, I mean, that feels like a choice. I feel like things are, like, purposely stagey. Like, they have flashbacks that are, like, obviously on the stage. Like, everything is blacked out around them. You know, where characters are, like, on a bed and they're surrounded by darkness. It's, like, obviously shooting on, like, a set or a stage. And in that sense, like, unlike Malignant, I wasn't like, oh, this is so stagey, or, oh, this is so obviously set. I was just like, oh, this is, like, a choice. The cruelty of the kills, the over-the-topness of the characters, and the shifting sympathy. I can think of other movies that do that, but none of them end in the same way as Sleepaway Camp. I mean, it really is so, like a unique film.
They didn't. They definitely didn't end the same way as Sleepaway Camp.
We've been talking about, like, swinging for the fences and, you know, it was this close and maybe it could have worked, but it just didn't. I'm thinking of Malignant here, but this is a movie that the term lightning in a bottle was made for. Because, yeah, on paper it shouldn't be this good. Like, it's trying too many difficult tonalities. Most people can't pull this together and create something cohesive and effective. But somehow Sleepaway Camp just nails it. And I love that. And I love that the movie is an unlikely success. I did want to mention that I saw Sleepaway Camp 2 not too long ago. And I considered it as, you know, something I would push or nominate. And I liked Pamela Springsteen. And I thought it had a lot of good qualities. But I didn't think it had that lightning in a bottle. Like, I don't think it transcended its budgetary and creative talent limitations. It kind of feels like the level of movie that it was, whereas I think Sleepaway Camp 1 just somehow, even though it came together almost out of the ether with people that were non-professional and inexperienced, it will live forever. I feel like you watch Sleepaway Camp 2, you're like, okay, yeah, I'm watching not direct-to-video, but kind of in that realm.
I disagree on subjective terms, only because, like, Sleepaway Camp 3, I think, fits the description that you're saying. I actually honestly love Sleepaway Camp 2. I think it's a really good movie. Enjoyable film.
And I don't disagree with that.
I think the real comp in this competition is between Sleepaway Camp and The Burning, which did not make the cut out of the first round. And for all the reasons that you're saying, The Burning had everything you would expect to be lightning in a bottle. It had Jason Alexander and Fisher Stevens and Holly Hunter and Harvey Weinstein and Bob Weinstein. And I mean, again, not that they're not awful people, but
people who went on to do big things, right?
People who went on to do big things. And this movie had none of those things, and it's better. It's a better movie. And so in many respects, I think you could look at Hell Knight the same way. Hell Knight, as I mentioned, has a whole bunch of extraordinarily talented people who really came together and made a movie better than its logline and trappings would suggest. It was a movie that really, really scared me when I was a kid. And I literally mean kid. I don't remember how old I was when I watched it. But it doesn't hold up in that respect. But it's also clearly professionally made by a lot of people who were really giving it their all. And I sort of respect that. And I think, Mike, I hadn't considered the gothic trappings of it in the context that you brought up, but I think you're absolutely right. I mean, it's right, you know, I mean, it's like fucking Daphne du Maurier mixed with Halloween. Like, that's
a why we have these conversations, man, to look at these movies and then talk about them and you see the movie in a different way.
100%, Mike, and I fucking missed you, man. Like, I missed your perspective. I missed those things that you bring to the table, dude. So I'm glad you're here, and I'm glad we were able to talk about it. But it doesn't mean that Sleepaway Camp isn't the better movie for reasons, again, largely that we can't talk about. Other good stuff going on that I think are probably on par, but the third act stuff in Sleepaway Camp I think is going to be a really fascinating conversation going forward in this competition. So, yeah, my vote goes to Sleepaway Camp.
And I thank both of you for kind of pointing out things about Hell Knight that, you know, maybe I didn't take seriously enough, though I did like it. But this is a pretty easy vote for me. Of all the movies we've discussed in the first round, I think Hell Knight is one of the last I would feel compelled to delve more deeply into. So, yeah, I'm going for Sleepaway Camp. Mike, final thoughts and your vote.
I would say this. When I was watching Hell Knight for the first time in decades, I was really liking this movie, and I was engaged with it. I thought it made a lot of smart and interesting creative choices. I was, and there was a period of time in the course of the watch that I was even thinking of this podcast. I was thinking about how I was going to craft my response, the whole monologue where I would do, my vote's going to go for Hell Knight. You guys are going to be surprised by this, and here's why. But ultimately, if this podcast is about figuring out what is the best slasher movie and why, I had to ask of myself between Hell Knight and Sleepaway Camp, if someone was to ask me what slasher movies to watch to understand the genre, Hell Knight is a movie that I think that you could watch and enjoy. If you're going to understand the genre, you have to watch Sleepaway Camp. That's the difference between the two. Sleepaway Camp is such a core film that it's, yes, you need to watch Sleepaway Camp, and then you watch Hell Knight if you like what you've seen. Thus, my vote is for Sleepaway Camp. It's one of the core films of the genre. I shouldn't for one second imply that in any way that it's homework, it's eating your vegetables. It's a really fun, funny, horrible, striking film.
No galoots, but that's part of its charm.
That is part of its charm. Is it break? We're subverting expectations this early in the genre.
Right.
Even Freddy Krueger is a small man.
Yeah.
He gets beaten up by a teenage girl.
I think it's fair to say he's not a galoot, so that kind of puts him more in this category.
His galootness comes from his supernatural powers.
Yep. Yep. That tears it. Good conversation, but Sleepaway Camp will rightly advance. You're the